Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I am joined by Dan Ponder to discuss his recently published book, Presidential Leverage, President's Approval and the American State. This book, published as part of Stanford University Press's series on studies in the modern presidency, explores the concept of presidential leverage, how much capacity the president has to accomplish goals, especially in terms of asserting power on Congress or in Congress as a president. But Ponder examines leverage in context, which makes his work particularly important and useful in our thinking about not only the executive, but also the legislature and the ways in which the branches and bodies operate in our political system. But I will let Dan dive more into the details as we discuss presidential leverage. First, of course, I want to welcome Dan Ponder onto the New Books in Political Science podcast and to ask him to tell us a bit about himself and how he came to this project. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Lily. Well, thank you for having me. I think this, when I think back about this project, it has consumed me far more than I ever thought it would. I am a professor at Drury University, which is a small liberal arts school in my hometown. I was teaching in Colorado for 13 years and had the opportunity to come back. And so this project has, the entire project has spread over a couple of decades now, I'm sad to say, and two universities. But I've been lucky to have support at both universities as I was able to move through this. But basically, it came about under pressure. I think in the acknowledgments, I say, you know, the roots of this are born in procrastination. It was 1995, back when we used to have to do the APSA, you know, actually write it up, put it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and send it away. And I think it literally was the night or two before it had to be postmarked. And I wasn't sure. And I had recently read Stephen Skoranek's book, The Politics Presidents Make, and I was fascinated by it. And I particularly remember a line out of that book where he says something, and I'm paraphrasing now, but he basically says something like, presidents stand paramount when other institutions of American government have essentially been laid to waste, you know, Congress or maybe less so the courts, maybe states in the federal system. And that's when presidents are likely to be able to assert their power. So I had also been interested in public expectations of the presidency, particularly the expectations gap. And one of the ways to look at that, of course, is looking at presidential approval. Now, that was another thing that had gone back into my days at graduate school, which was, you know, it always was interesting to me that we looked at a pretty ubiquitous number, which is presidential approval. And I always thought, well, it'd be interesting to also see what Congress or the court. And little had been done, or at least that I had been introduced to. And then I think in around that same year, there was a book put out by John Hibbing and Elizabeth Thies-Morse called Congress's Public Enemy. And they started to take things like congressional approval into account. And I thought, you know, it is interesting because, you know, we live in a separated system. We have separation of powers, checks and balances. But we only really looked at presidential approval. And I started playing around with ways to maybe get at Skowronek's idea. And anyway, to make a very long story short, I kind of, after a couple of iterations, had come up with, well, what if we looked at the presidency in context and looked at the presidency, presidential approval in context of, I think the first iteration I was looking at confidence in the different institutions of government, Congress, the presidency, as opposed to the president and the courts. And then I just made some sort of average. And then after having done some more reading and remembering back to my days in graduate school, where we also had to take a second exam for our prelims, and I had taken comparative. And one of the things that I had taken in comparative politics that really interested me was the role of the state writ large. And I had written some stuff on this in the mid 2000, around 2004, 2005. And then it occurred to me that I could kind of marry the two. And so one of the underlying, Elaine Kamark, had written a really interesting piece in the book, in a Brookings publication, about how trust is the undergirding of the American state, or of the idea of the state. And so a little light kind of went off in my head, that thinking, okay, instead of just looking at these averages, what if I looked at trust in government? And then I could marry the idea of the presidency as the face of the American state and in the American state at the same time. So that's kind of a long-winded way of saying how I got into it. But I had other projects going. I published my first book in 2000, and I had done some other things as well. I thought about maybe a textbook on the presidency, but leverage and the idea of leverage never left my mind. And then I was at a conference for Jimmy Carter's 30th inaugural anniversary, and I was eating dinner with my old dissertation chairman, Irwin Hargrove, and he asked me what I was working on, and I had done a paper at this conference. And while it wasn't just about leverage, there was some leverage. And I had said, but I'm also thinking about a presidential textbook. And he said, I remember him saying, does the world really need another presidency textbook? And I said, well, I don't know. But he said, why don't you think about working on this other stuff? That sounds kind of interesting. And fast forward another 5 years, because like I said, I just got back to a small liberal arts college, which I love, but they, you know, focus on teaching. But they also really respect and value research. But I didn't get a sabbatical till 2012. And I thought, you know what, why not? This is what kind of where my passion is, instead of trying to clear other things. I'm kind of a dessert after dinner kind of guy. And so I thought, well, let me finish all these things and then I'll really focus on what I want to. But then that pile of other possibilities kept growing. And I thought, you know what, life is a little bit too short. And so I just decided to dive into this. So I started the sabbatical in the fall of 2012. And then, you know, a little bit of research time during the school year, but then really intense research summers. And finally finished the book and was gracious. And Shirley Warshaw, who was at Gettysburg College, but is the editor of this series at Stanford, had asked if she could take a look at it. And we met at APSA, APSA in 2014, I think. And we talked a little bit about it. And then I delivered the manuscript a couple years later. So
awesome. I mean, that is an interesting odyssey of the sort of germination or the idea, and how, you know, you sort of came and went from it, but it stayed with you. And I think that's really clear in the book itself, that you dive into the complexity of, as you say, not just leverage, but sort of how the role of the presidency is is sort of fixed in the state and the relationship between the, you know, the state itself, the nation state, and where the president and the presidency are in that. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about presidential leverage, because this obviously is title of the book, and the impetus for you to sort of explore the, these many threads that you have woven together. You define in detail it is not just about presidential leverage, as you already mentioned, but as a more complex assessment of what political scientists come to mean by political leverage. And that is not just about the president kind of in this vacuum. Could you explain a bit about what this term means and how you define and discuss it in the book?
Right. That's a good question. To me, what I was thinking was instead of power, you know, because so much of the literature on the presidency has talked about power, whether it was Neustadt's power to persuade or Howell and other people's, you know, power without persuasion, or is it, you know, going even way back to Edward Corwin, is power basically the sum total of what the Constitution gives the president? It even sort of delves into this, you know, the stewardship versus the Whig presidency. You know, is the Constitution a limiting document, as the Whigs thought? In other words, if it didn't say specifically what the president could do, then he can't do it, versus Teddy Roosevelt, right, who said, you know, well, no, if the Constitution doesn't explicitly say you can't, then I'm all for it. And one of the things that I found really interesting, and I certainly can't take credit for it, I think, and I would refer listeners who are interested, Joseph Cooper has some really interesting chapters in I think it's Congress Reconsidered. I'd have to look at that. I don't remember if it's the Nelson Reader. I think it's the other one, but where he talks about how Congress, has, sort of taking a back seat. So one of the things that was interesting to me was this idea that I call institutional inversion. And that is, without much being said, you know, most of the constitutional changes in the presidency have to do with how we elect the president. But yet, with without much detailing presidential power, you know, the presidency has kind of taken a front seat, has almost moved above Congress in terms of how we think about presidential relationships with the state. You know, the president, I have several vignettes about presidents being, you know, and seeing themselves even as at least the face of the state. And so the idea was, what I kind of wanted to try to get away a little bit from the idea of power. And that's, I don't even know or when I came up with the term leverage. It must have been for that first paper, because I remember it was called Presidential Leverage. But the idea is, when can a president leverage, you know, support, or in other things, I've called it the president's place in the political system, or the president's place in the American state, and use that to extract action, perhaps concurrence from Congress and things. And what I found was sometimes it really is starkly present, and other times not. And I do talk about that in the book as well. So for me, the idea of leverage isn't so much, you know, power, but how other institutions, particularly Congress, but not just Congress, and the public see the president as a source of political action and dynamic action in the American political system.
And that's, I mean, the source of dynamic action, as opposed to what we often think about with regard to Congress as, you know, slow and not very oftentimes aggressive action in certain regards. And you discuss this idea of leverage within our constitutional system. Can you talk a little bit about how and where you see this kind of leverage, and to a degree, the power that ultimately is associated with it, even if it is distinct from constitutionally outlined powers, situated within the Constitution and thus within the United States system?
Yeah, I do talk a little bit about other forms of leverage, right? Because, you know, constitutionally derived forms of leverage. So, for example, the veto is an obvious one. And you know, and all the things that go with the veto, right? The president just doesn't have to just veto a bill to assert leverage, but can, you know, threaten the veto, and then hopefully, from his standpoint, there will be a change in how the bill comes out, or will there be a response to a veto threat? So there are other places in the Constitution, and where I see this as sort of a public source of presidential leverage. So there's the constitutionally derived ones, and there's the public one. And a lot of this has to do with the idea that, you know, it is both a blessing and a curse for presidents to be seen as the face of the American state, because, you know, this goes back to the discussion earlier about presidential expectations, where a president, right or wrong, is held responsible for a bad economy and rewarded for a good economy, even though what he and someday she does will have maybe, you know, sometimes more, sometimes less, certainly foreign affairs, things like that. So it goes back to this idea of expectations, and that generally I think we also saw, or the literature tends to see expectations as a hindrance on the president, but of course it can also be a source of power, where, you know, we expect the president to do something about that, where perhaps, you know, it wasn't seen as legitimate, you know, 100 years ago or whatnot. So I see this as, you know, you have presidents have constitutionally derived leverage, you know, things like, which I also look sometimes as dependent variables, but, you know, what they can do unilaterally, and that has been, you know, passed on by the Supreme Court and so forth, what they can do unilaterally, what they can do, you know, specifically via the Constitution, like I said, with vetoes. But then this is sort of the public source where, you know, if a president has higher leverage, and the way it's defined, I almost hate to say mathematically, because it's just a, you know, a very simple, it's the president's, for your listeners, it's the president's approval divided by trust in government at any one time. And I go into a lot of detail in the book about how that's measured. And, you know, I take some from Luke Keel, and then I extend it and use an algorithm developed by James Stimson. But the point is that it's really a different way of looking at trust. And the way that we look at trust, or the way I have it in trust, is it specifically does not ask the questions that are put into the algorithm are not about a president, or even, you know, I might ask about I have the questions in an appendix or in the footnotes in the book. And it's specifically, if it says, do you trust, say, you know, Barack Obama or George W. Bush, then that's actually not used. Or do you trust Nancy Pelosi or Newt Gingrich? You know, I want people to think about, what I wanted was questions. And I think, like I said, I derive a lot of this from the work of others. You know, if I'll do this with my students sometimes, actually. I'll say, okay, if I say Washington, D.C., or I say the government, what do you think of specifically? And it's really interesting to hear what they say. Some will say, some will actually say more like, here, I'm here in Missouri. So some of people say, well, like Jefferson City, but most will say something to do with the federal government. They'll say, I think of the president, or I think of Congress. And some will say, I think of the whole thing. And that's kind of how actually I do it. When I think of the federal government, I literally have in my mind this view of Washington, D.C., you know, that has, and I can see all of it. For me, that's what it is. So I want to leave up to the specific respondent what he or she is saying when they ask, do you trust the federal government? One of the big questions is, do you trust the federal government to do what's right? And so I want the respondent, I want questions that measure what the respondent, and I, you know, without the questioner leading them, what do you think about, you know, Donald Trump or Barack Obama? You know, I want the person to think about it themselves. So I'm curious about, so when a president's approval is higher, and say political trust is lower, to me, that's when a president has, more leverage. Because as I think I put it in the book colloquially, you know, the president is the best, or even sometimes the only game in town, right? And so presidents post Watergate have actually been been advantaged by this because Vietnam and then Watergate, if you look at in it, you know, at almost any graph of public trust, and I certainly have some in the book, that you'll see, you know, political trust was actually pretty big coming out of the Eisenhower administration, pretty high coming out of the Eisenhower administration into the Kennedy administration. Then it sort of hits Vietnam, and then it starts to fall throughout the 60s. And then you get into the Watergate era, and it really kind of bottoms out. And so one thing I like about the way that I think about, or for me, what works is that leverage is more than approval. It's a relative measure. So a president can actually be, let's say, relatively unpopular, you know, with popularity ratings in the, say, the lower 50s or even the upper 40s, and still have a degree of leverage if public trust is, you know, particularly low. On the other hand, you know, John F. Kennedy, for example, he didn't have a lot of what I call leverage. I mean, he did, he certainly had some because he was popular, but at the same time, you know, public trust was also very high. So, you know, people trusted government as a whole, but they also trusted, you know, he was popular. So there wasn't anything over and above. So, you know, one of the things I have in the book is looking at sort of a pre versus post Watergate dynamic in terms of leverage. So I try to get at it. It sounds a lot more complex than it is. It really is. It's just the higher your leverage, the more the more the president sort of, it goes back to Skowronek stands. I don't, by the way, say that the leverage is a direct, by any means is a direct test of Skowronek, far from it, but that's where it came from. But the idea is that the higher that index, the more the president stands away from and above, the rest of the political system, and the closer it is together, then it's not that the president's necessarily weak, but that there's really, you know, people trust government and they trust the president, and so there's really nothing overly special or different about the presidency in those periods.
That, I mean, and I think that's what's interesting, is it's not just this question of presidential approval, that you're looking specifically at presidential approval, trust in government, also what Congress is up to, and how they're also seen, or members of Congress or Congress as a whole are also seen. So that it's sort of this, as you say, it's a kind of dynamic understanding of how we, the citizens, also think about our government, which I think is important. So it's, you know, and again, it's a distinction. Oftentimes the literature on the presidency is about, you know, how much, as you say, how much power does the president have? How many things did the has the president accomplished in a short period of time, the first 100 days? But this is a kind of distinction that most of us don't always think about, which I think is why the book is really good. You also talk about the role that the media plays in regard to presidential leverage. How do you sort of situate that within not only your algorithm, but also your analysis?
Yeah, the media, and I think, you know, one of the things, and again, I'm drawing on the work of others, Joseph Cooper in particular, one of the things that has sort of moved us into this age of institutional inversion has been the growth of media. And while I don't incorporate any measure of media per se, that is definitely one of the things that I've been sort of thinking about in, you know, future endeavors, where I, you know, either improve upon or at least extend the idea of leverage, because it certainly can be done. You know, there's a lot, and I think the media is another, you know, tool for presidents, and that, you know, whether or not approval ratings, job, you know, whether it's job approval, personal approval, or policy approval, you know, I know one of the big debates is, of course, whether or not presidential rhetoric can move systematically these things. I think it's through the lens of the media that allows us to the president can somewhat shape. Now, I will say a number of years ago, somebody asked about this. I think it was a reviewer for an article. And I said, well, you know, my response was, I don't necessarily see a president being able to systematically undercut the government rhetorically, which would be, you know, a strategy if a president, you know, this isn't, by the way, of course, something that the president comes downstairs, you know, out of the residence and says, how's my leverage today? The way that,
no, I don't think so.
The way he or she might look at, right. No, but the way he or she might look, right. You know, look at their approval ratings. Right. But so the way I used to do this, and I did have a friend who was reading this and said, you know, maybe don't say that unless you want to say that. I used to call it sort of it's a measured feeling, you know, it's kind of an aura in a way. You know, think about the Watergate era, for example, and then say Carter. You know, one of the things that someone had once said to me at a conference was like, well, you need to change the name of it. You know, because, you know, it's not really leverage, because specifically they were talking about, if you look at, say, 1977, Jimmy Carter has pretty high leverage. And he said, Carter have high leverage. And I thought about it for a second. I thought, well, I would still stick with leverage because, you know, it seems to have some face validity because, you know, Carter was the first post-Watergate, post-Vietnam president. You know, he said, I won't lie to you. And so, the country was really kind of looking for this. Now, if he had had high leverage in, say, 79 or 80, I might have thought, okay, there's something to that. But, and that's what I mean by, you know, you look at it uncovers things. Some of the things you aren't going to be surprised at, right? Some of them are like, Jimmy Carter. I think the one big one was maybe Jimmy Carter in 77, but it's not going to surprise anybody that Johnson toward the end of his presidency or Nixon right before he resigned had kind of bottomed out. And then Ford had a fairly, you know, his first few months was pretty high in terms of leverage. And he was sort of taking advantage of this idea that, okay, you know, our long national nightmare is over, as he said. And so his approval was a little bit higher, and trust in government though was still down. And then, you know, things happened and that got squandered and he lost, the 1976 election. And a lot of that, to go back to your original question, I think had a lot to do with how the media, has shifted over time. And that, you know, perhaps the current administration has made me rethink a little bit about the degree to which a president maybe can try at least to systematically undercut, you know, other institutions in government. I'll confess maybe to a little bit of naivete a few years ago when somebody asked me about that. And I thought, well, you know, I guess I could see maybe them trying. I mean, all presidents try to, or most presidents try to, you know, there's the politics of blame and blame avoidance and sometimes accepting, you know, most notably, right, the example that's used a lot is Kennedy in the Bay of Pigs, you know, okay, I take full responsibility for that. And that actually redounded to his favor. But the media, you know, I think maybe in this new era, and the book literally was due to the press like a month after the election, the 2016 election. And so I only literally mentioned Trump maybe on the last page or two, and it's all in the future. He hadn't even been inaugurated yet. So in future iterations of you know, papers or whatever I decide to do with this, I'm going to have to explicitly take that into account, because at least you do have a president who systematically tries to do that, maybe in a much starker way than has been the case in past presidencies, or at least that's my read on it.
And I mean, and again, we're often faced as political scientists trying to analyze the Trump presidency in ways that we apply to previous presidents. And in some places, those analyses make sense, and in other, you know, and can give us good information and conclusions. But in other places, we're kind of flummoxed. And so I think, you know, you're correct in that, you know, the way that you're talking about trust in government and the approval of the president and the approval of the president's actions and the president's rhetoric in the Trump administration is perhaps a different dynamic than most of the contemporary presidents.
I absolutely agree with that. I, you know, colloquially, again, when people ask about it, you say, you know, one of the ways that we as political scientists try to model or at least formulate some sort of predictive capacity is because we can draw on, you know, previous presidencies, different circumstances, different contexts, different parties, different relationships to parties, and so forth. But President Trump is different, I think, in many ways. You know, especially if you look at the early battles over trying to repeal Obamacare, right? He was much more at war. I mean, to be fair, the Democrats weren't really going to go along with it anyway. So he was very much at war with his own party and undercut Congress and so on and so forth. So yeah, it is a little bit different. And that's one thing that I'm going to have to wrestle with as I take this into the future is how to capture that. And maybe it doesn't apply as well. Although there were some things, I think, that President Trump has done or, you know, that's very much in line. Can I talk real quick about one of the interesting findings of the book? One of the interesting findings of the book, I thought, was that a lot of the movement is actually on low-leveraged presidents. And I also have a part in the last chapter where I try to talk about the domain of the theory, like where I thought that maybe this would, you know, that leverage would have an impact and it doesn't. One of the things that was surprising to me is that a lot of the movement in terms of, I have what I call the macro political environment and the micro political environment. So, for example, one place where as leverage increases, the proportion of significant laws that originate with the president increases. I won't bore your listeners with it, but, you know, I use Mayhew's list of major significant policies, and then I cross-listed originally with Andy Rulevich's list of legislation that was proposed, that was, you know, made and conducted and centralized in the presidency, in the White House, and I sort of cross-list the two. So if a major piece of legislation on Mayhew's list was also on that list, or using other sources later on to show that it was mostly out of the presidency, that I counted, you know, so it was sort of big, significant policies that originated in the presidency. There, as leverage increases, so does the proportion of those laws increase. But other places, so for example, now this may not be surprising, unilateral political action like executive orders, as presidential leverage increases, you know, the amount of executive orders that are issued decreases. And if you flip that on its side, you know, or even upside down, what you get, I think, interestingly, is that these low-leveraged presidents are the ones who have to act and use unilateral powers. But also, interestingly, State of the Union requests, again, that are done in the White House. You know, there's a couple of different things. One of them is State of the Union requests that the president has made, or at least, you know, in the White House or in the executive branch, and they are bringing to Congress to ask them to, you know, to do something, to pass their legislation. What I found, which I think was surprising, was that as leverage increases, as the index of presidential leverage increases, the number of State of the Union requests decreases. Or again, to put it another way, low leverage presidents are likely to ask for a lot more. Yeah, and try. And it seems to me, and one of the interesting things that I think I'd like to try to do is some of these, you know, and then if you look at centralization of policy as presidential leverage increases, presidents are less likely to centralize policy in the White House. What's interesting about those things is those seem to be fairly consistent with prospect theory, which is an area that I've found fascinating to read about and think about. And so it makes some sense where if a president is low leverage, maybe less powerful, they're going to try, you know, let's I don't mean to put it so starkly, but yeah, let's throw the pasta against the wall and see what sticks. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, because yeah, that's how, so, but it's interesting. If you look at like the size of the EOP and the political staff, high leverage presidents like, you know, Reagan or Clinton or Obama, they don't move much. You know, they don't add or subtract too much, or at least in terms of the numbers that I have. But again, it's presidents that are sort of in trouble in terms of leverage are much more likely to add political staff. So anyway, that was one of the more interesting things that I found in the book that I think can be explained. And one place I want to explore later is applying the idea of prospect theory. But yeah, that may be a place where I wasn't exactly expecting to find what I found.
And in that context, I would really love for you to give us a few of your favorite key examples of high leverage, low leverage, you know, sort of attempts at policy, and how you saw the, you know, the sort of structure of your analysis work out.
Sure. Yeah, I guess, you know, again, going back to my Carter example, that was one surprise. You know, if you look at all of them, it does make sense. You know, the three big peaks are Carter in 77, George H.W. Bush in about 1991, and then George W. Bush in 2001. But you also have some interesting things. You know, so if you take President Obama, for example, as I say in the book, that, you know, if Kennedy's experience constitutes a concrete example of the relative nature of the measure, Obama's first term is a veritable poster child. No president that I looked at, you know, came to office with a greater promise of changing things. But you know, so here he was. There were some interesting things, and you get this with Bill Clinton, that, you know, if you look at averages, and one of the things I do have in the book is Z-scores, because I always just like to do that because it makes it easy to identify the outliers. And so, for example, Bill Clinton was interesting, or at least his leverage, because a lot of times he was below average in terms of approval. But trust was so low that he actually had high trust. You know, he was above average in leverage, but below average in approval, if that makes sense. And Obama to some degree as well, you know, because Obama famously sort of lingered in the, you know, mid to upper 40s to lower 50s, but he constantly had very high leverage. And I think part of that was, of course, you know, George, one interesting thing, I guess, too, is George W. Bush, because he had among the highest, in fact, I think his leverage at one point might have been among the highest of anyone. But after 9/11, that's true. But the interesting thing, too, is it wasn't overly high. And the reason was because, you know, all other institutions rose as well. I think I remember reading something, I don't think I put it in the book, but one interesting thing, I think it was by James Stimson, showed that I'm sure I'm going to get this wrong, but like the mayor of Sacramento, you know, trust and approval in the mayor of Sacramento rose dramatically after 9/11. People were just, you know, much more, is a rally around the flag effect. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so, but, you know, Bush, I think, was another one. And then especially toward the end, where he had a bit rougher road in his second term, you know, especially after Katrina, but then also after the midterms in 2006, then you really had a decline in trust. And so, you know, you have another example where I think Obama was... I don't have it right in front of me, but I think he was another example where a lot of times his average approval was below, you know, had a negative Z score, a slightly negative Z score, but yet he had a well above average leverage because, you know, I hate to say it like this, but, you know, presidents can take advantage of the fact that Americans don't trust government. Now, that's not a normative statement. You know, I don't like that as a political scientist. You know, I don't like that. But I mean, presidents, you know, it also leads to the idea that they're looking more and more at presidents. And again, I'm going to have to do some more systematic research on Donald Trump, especially as his term continues to proceed. But that to me, again, was another interesting aspect.
Yeah. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit, because this has sort of come up a bit in our conversation, that you spend a good part of the book discussing the role of Congress in regard to leverage, in part because of the role of, as you note, the president's co-partisans and their role in Congress. But of course, you also have the role of the opposition in Congress as part of what comes into the analysis. So can you explain a bit about how Congress in the co-partisan to the presidents and also the opposition contribute to our understanding of sort of the dynamic leverage analysis?
Right. And I know that there's some controversy with some of the measures in terms, especially one of the things that I wanted to do. And of course, there were statistical problems. So I have an appendix, statistical problems in terms of multicollinearity. So I hope that doesn't drop off too many of the listeners.
Stay with us.
I know. Sorry. I'm getting somewhere. But the idea was, I think one of the things that I was interested in was looking at not just the institutional divide of government. So I have a couple of different measures. One is just the usual divided government, a dummy variable, coded one when there was divided government and zero when there wasn't. But also, I think in the main analysis is interesting is because I'm also looking at an era when we, even before we were so polarized, right? You really start to see polarization really start to grow in the Clinton administration and then accelerate under Bush and then Obama. And even though I haven't systematically done the work, but I think probably as well under Trump. So one of the things that I was looking at was also wondering about not just institutionally, do we have divided or unified government, but do we have how close is the president in terms of his ideology to the median member of Congress? And so that was an and I found out that in many instances, that was a stronger, more interesting predictor than just simply whether or not Congress was run by opponents, the partisan opposition, or whether or not he had more co-partisans. So I think that, the role of Congress, I think, one of the most interesting books on American politics I've read in some time is Francis Lee's book on looking at beyond ideology. And it really, I saw fit quite nicely with her analysis because, she's saying that, we tend to look at things like ideologically charged, but even, even policies that have no real ideological content or should have a natural partisan home. I think one example she uses is like, funding for NASA or something is still, a president is kind of, can be the, I think there was an article by Siegelman and some people, the kiss of death, right? If for somebody, if the president is for it, I'm against it. And then there is, and there is a piece that I look at in Congress that I took from Mann and Ornstein, but looking at how it's not just leverage for presidents, because what they can do is this had to do, I think, with the budget and looking at, how can it was one of those where we were going to fall off the fiscal cliff, right? And then it was a matter of no matter what we can do, or if, then Obama started to agree with what the Republican leadership wanted to do, and then they decided not to do it. And that's not a shot at any particular party, but that also just shows the increasing dynamics. So one of the things that was more interesting for me was to see that this, and it was using nominate scores. And I know there's, issues with nominate scores, but I generally think they capture something important. And so looking at sort of this ideological proximity variable as well as, simply, what party controls Congress and are they the president's co-partisans or are they opposition really has some interesting things to say about what the fate of presidential activity.
I mean, I think this is a really fascinating way to kind of explore what I think for you and your analysis is really a kind of dynamic way to analyze presidents, but also one that, you know, gives us, I think, a pretty good handle on oftentimes like what presidents are doing, how they're doing it, and to a degree, why they're doing it.
Why they're doing it, right. I agree. And so I find myself thinking about that, you know, as we all do as political scientists or even just people interested in politics, you know, with the current administration and how that plays out against previous administrations and so forth. And you know, I do think to the degree that it provides some other type of dynamic and insight because it puts the public, you know, in a sense, leverage measures where the president is, not just in the state, but in the public's mind, right? And so that's why I called it the quantification of a feeling, but I deferred to my the friend that was reading it over who said, well, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't call it that unless you want to. And I was like, well, you're probably right. I probably don't want to say that. But it tends to be something like that. Like I said earlier, you know, it's not the kind of thing the president's going to come down and ask to see, you know, what's my leverage rating today? He probably wants to know what his approval rating is, but it's also going to, I think, lead into a larger aura or if you will, feeling about what's going on in Washington and where the president is situated in that, especially in the public mind, as well as the state.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as we move into this election season and any election season, that's oftentimes, you know, this very ethereal around the edges sort of conceptualization of what do I think of the body politic? And oftentimes that is, what do I think about the president? But it's not just about the president. I mean, that's why I think your book is really important because you're showing us it's not just about the president. He's an actor in there with all of these other components that help us think about we as citizens, you know, what do we think about the state and the state of the state?
Exactly. And that's why I was able to go back and look at, you know, and it was a lot of fun for me, frankly, to go back and read some of that stuff that, you know, I thought when I, in 1992, when I took my comparative politics prelim, I thought, all right, I am done with that. But it was really fun to go back and kind of take a look at some of this other stuff and see how it applies to American politics today.
And so you've talked a lot about like taking some of this forward, in part because the book went to the press
right
a month yeah. after Donald Trump was elected.
Exactly, yeah.
Which, you know, happened to many of us in many things. So what are you working on now, Dan?
Well, I'm about to have another sabbatical. So what I'm thinking about doing is, of course, writing sort of, but I was telling a colleague the other day, I don't know if I'll call it Trump in the age of leverage or leverage in the age of Trump. But yeah, that's one of the things. So really, you know, trying to bring the current administration up as current as I can. And then I'm also thinking about, frankly, doing, you know, looking at, like I said, a prospect theory and how it might impact some of the findings that I have. And then there's also something that I've thought about doing since I was in graduate school. And that's, and I have no idea how I would do this or where I would start with, but I've done some archival work in my career. I've done some statistical work in my career. I've never done something with like interviews and focus groups and things. And especially not, you know, for a number of reasons, I've always kind of wanted to look at sort of Catholics in politics. I happen to be a Catholic. And so I've always been interested in that. And especially at this particular moment in time, as well as, you know, other types of issues, why you have these very conservative Catholics, but also the more liberal or Pope Francis type Catholics. So anyway, that's at best, I'll get a research design out of the sabbatical for that. But certainly in terms of this project, bringing the current administration more explicitly into the framework, and then again looking at prospect theory as a way to explain some of these findings that I was talking about earlier.
Well, it sounds like you have three different projects, but when one of the books comes out, possibly on Catholics and politics, would you please come back on the New Books in Political Science podcast and talk to us about it?
I absolutely would. Right. I would love that.
Thank you today for joining me today, Dan Ponder, and for this great book, Presidential Leverage, President's Approval and the American State, which is published by Stanford University Press. And I always like my authors to give a shout out to wherever you like to buy books, perhaps in a brick and mortar store.
Absolutely. I actually still go. I used to work in a bookstore, so I'm a huge fan, but I like to go to Barnes & Noble.
Okay. So you can get a hold of this book at Barnes & Noble or have them order it for you, I bet.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Lily.